initiates or procures with malice and without probable cause the prosecution of an innocent person. This court has declared in numerous opinions, particularly Browning-Ferris versus Lee, that the tort of malicious prosecution involves a delicate balance between society's interest in the efficient enforcement of criminal law and an individual's interest in freedom from oppressive and unjustifiable criminal prosecution. This court has declared that strict proof of each element is required, and even a small departure from the exact prerequisites for liability threatens this delicate balance. Implicit in all of the court's writings on malicious prosecution is that the burden is on law enforcement officials to know the elements of a crime and to ask the right questions. The burden is not on private citizens to know what information to give law enforcement officials. The only burden placed on a private citizen is to report truthful information to law enforcement officials. There is also a presumption that the private citizen in reporting suspected criminal activity acts reasonably and in good faith. In Browning-Ferris versus Leak, in King versus Graham, and Walmart versus Rodriguez, this court declared that the tort of malicious prosecution is different from other torts. This court has stated that general tort principles regarding causation do not apply to the tort of malicious prosecution.
What about if there is an intentional failure to report exculpatory information?
Your Honor,
would that be enough?
No, Your Honor. This court has declared that when the decision to prosecute is left to the discretion of another, there must be proof that the complainant knowingly furnished false information to law enforcement officials, and that is not the only requirement. There's an additional requirement that there must be proof that the false information caused the criminal prosecution.
But can't information be false if the person reporting has a key piece of evidence that they're hiding and they report it? I mean, why would that not be enough? Isn't that false information?
The court has declared, Your Honor, in Browning-Ferris versus Lee, the failure to make full and fair disclosure.
But isn't that different? Failure to make full and fair disclosure, isn't that different from intentionally hiding relevant exculpatory evidence?
We don't believe that it is, Your Honor. This court, because of the delicate balance of the competing interest intention, has looked at the restatement, and the restatement has defined procurement in such a manner that requires failure to give false information, that the complaining witness must give false information, and that false information must have caused the indictment. That is the only basis for liability.
You're saying it's only false if there's an affirmative statement. It can never be false from omission.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is our position. The investigator who investigated this case has testified in this court that every piece of information that the bank gave was truthful information. Your Honor?
Let me understand just one thing, following up on what Justice O'Neill said. Do you agree that Mr. Villanueva's statement was misleading?
No, Your Honor.
Not even misleading?
No, Your Honor. Do not. The investigator testified that based on his investigation, every piece of information that the bank official gave to the investigator was true.
But
this is what the court has declared.
But that's not established as a matter of law.
No, Your Honor.
And there is some evidence that the bank didn't advise the investigator about the whereabouts of at least 42 cattle.
No, Your Honor.
The existence of an essential payout agreement or an alternative agreement.
Your Honor,
these may be controverted facts, but aren't they there in the record? And don't we?
They are controverted facts, Your Honor. But this is the way this case happened. When the bank was concerned about its collateral on a defaulted note from a customer who vowed never to be seen again, the bank called an investigator. The investigator came. The bank gave a statement to the investigator. And it is important to look at the statement that the investigator took from the bank employee. The bank did not accuse Martin of a crime. The bank did not seek to have Martin prosecuted. The bank did not seek to have Martin arrested. Well, the bank did not testify before the grand jury. The bank gave truthful information, Your Honor. All the bank did was, as any private citizen has a legal right to do, is report suspected criminal activity. The party stipulated here that the discretion to prosecute or not, if the facts fit the crime, was placed in the district attorney and in the grand jury. This court has declared in Browning Ferris versus Leake and in King versus Graham that if those are the facts, if no false information is given and the false information did not cause the indictment, there is no basis for liability.
When does a prosecutor not have the discretion whether to prosecute or not? I mean, I hear you saying that, but what kind of facts would there be where the false light would be a tort? I mean, you speak of a dichotomy, but I don't see a case where the prosecutor doesn't retain that decision, you know, as a matter of constitutional setup.
The restatement speaks to that, and it speaks to that in terms of initiation. When the complainant puts pressure on the district attorney or... and that pressure caused the indictment. In that situation, Your Honor, the complaining witness initiated a complaint, and we're
so
over the hurdle.
You'll subpoena under your scheme, under your vision of how the average case would work. You would subpoena everybody who was or is in the district attorney's office who dealt with this and ask them subjectively how they felt about the complainant's desire to have a prosecution.
Your Honor, when this court has declared in Ritchie versus Brookshire that if the objective elements of the crime are satisfied, there cannot be lack of probable cause as a matter of law. In this case, we had the objective elements of the crime of hindering a secured creditor. We had.
What if the note had been fully paid and the bank hadn't said the note has been fully paid?
If the bank, there is no basis to file a complaint.
And well, that's
bank,
what I'm saying.
If the bank files a complaint, but here the bank did not file a complaint in any way, shape, or form, Your Honor.
I understand, but if they had reported to the prosecutor, we think that our collateral has been stolen or is missing, even though the note had been paid in full, would there be, and they intended to do that, they just didn't like him, and they reported that the cattle were missing, but they didn't report the note had been paid in full. Could that be a basis for malicious prosecution?
There may be, Your Honor, but that is not our case.
I understand that.
That is not our case.
I understand that. But could it be? Well, if those were the facts, could that be the basis of malicious prosecution?
Well, Your Honor, if that court wants to go in that direction, the court's going to have to change Brown and Ferris versus Leake.
So
the court is going to have to overrule King versus Graham, and the court's going to have to rule Walmart versus Rodriguez.
So your answer then is even then, no malicious prosecution?
Because the court's already declared what the standards are for malicious prosecution, Your Honor. The court has required that for civil liability, for the tort of malicious prosecution, dealing with the causation element, the court has stated that the requirement is that the complaining witness give false information knowingly, and that that false information caused the indictment.
Let me ask you about that. No, I'm sorry.
Well, would that be false information? That would be giving false information. My scenario of not revealing that the note was paid.
I don't know, Your Honor. You're going to have to tell us. Under the current state of the law, there is no basis for liability in this case.
We're dealing with a charge that says unless the person fails to fully and fairly disclose all material information known to him. And that's how it was submitted to the jury. Now, if it was submitted that way, shouldn't we be bound by the law as given to the charge? What was the objection on the record to that?
Your Honor, in Browning Ferris versus Leake, and we've given you a handout, the procurement charge that was requested by the court, by the bank. The bank requested verbatim, the definition of procurement that the court mandated in Browning Ferris versus Leake. The court was so concerned that there be confusion in this matter, the court stated this is the definition should be given in future cases. That's the instruction that we requested, and we cited Brian Ferris versus Leak as a source of our instruction. The court refused to give this instruction. The court modified the instruction and expanded liability to include failure to make full and fair disclosure, which is in direct conflict with Browning Ferris versus Leak and King versus Graham.
But I've pulled the record to see if there was an objection on the record to that instruction, and it's not there. So how did you preserve this? Was it simply by giving, do you preserve in a trial an objection to an instruction when the court substantially modifies it and no objection is lodged to that modification?
Your Honor, this court has held in State Department of Public Highways, Public Transportation versus Pang, that is what is required to preserve error when you give an instruction that this court says must be given. There must be a complaint, it must be timely, and we must obtain a ruling. We complied with every respect, as the Court of Appeals found. The Court of Appeals found that there was no error.
Payne said the gist of it is, does the trial court know you're dissatisfied with the charge and have an opportunity to get it right? And what on the record shows us that the trial court was apparently trying to split the baby here. So I guess. Sometimes trial judges do that. And how did the trial court know that you were unhappy with the compromise that he or she wrote in?
Because the court refused to give the instruction that we told the court should be given based on what this court declared in Browning Ferris versus Leak, and the court modified and substantially modified what this court said should not be done.
But I mean, essentially, any time you give a piece of writing to the judge, and that's not in the final charge, error is preserved under Payne. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. Our position
is it short of you saying, well, thanks for what you gave us, but it's still wrong. Short of that, where is the line then?
Rule 276 provides, Your Honor, that a properly endorsed or modified instruction shall constitute a bill of exceptions, and it shall be conclusively presumed that all requirements of the law have been observed. As long as the record indicates in some way that the trial court ruled on the objection, either expressly or implicitly through its actions, error is preserved. Now, how more plain can it be when we ask the court to give the instruction or the definition of procurement that this court mandated in Browning Ferris versus Leak? The court refuses and modifies and marks it, modifies as follows, and then expands.
The judge didn't exactly write on this charge all the words that are in Rule 276. I mean, the judge didn't put the "and exception allowed." That is part of that language.
Your Honor,
so I'm trying to understand where, after Payne, the line comes between just handing the judge something and making a formal set of objections.
Your Honor, this court has already ruled on that matter in Dallas Market Center Development Company versus Leindecker, citing Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1A2, this court stated that a trial court's endorsement of refused is not required. As long as the record indicates in some way that the trial court ruled on the objection, either expressly or implicitly. Now, how can, by implication, Your Honor, when we request a charge that this court says should be given, and the court refuses to give that charge, and says as modified, and expand the basis of liability to include failure to fully disclose, Your Honor, by implication, the court denied our objection, our requested charge, and nothing more is required.
What about the harmless error rule? Wouldn't that apply to that?
No, Your Honor. This court has stated in Browning Ferris versus Lee, when you do not give the instruction that this court mandates, it is error. That was the issue in Browning Ferris versus Leak, Your Honor, and nothing more was required.
The
harmless error rule does not come into play.
Are you arguing that we have a commingling here of a valid and invalid theory?
Your Honor, that's a fallback position, you know, Castillo. But our main argument here, Your Honor, is even if the correct charge had been given, there is no basis of liability in this case because there's no clear and convincing evidence of malice. There is no evidence that the bank procured the charge or initiated the charge.
Let me ask you a question, one more question on this. I tried to ask you a while ago. Let's assume that the question is asked, or this statement was made. The bank can't find any of the cattle. Cannot find any of the cattle. When the bank knew of these other cattle in existence, is that a true or false statement?
Your Honor, the bank gave to the investigator the file. The file included a check for cattle that had been purchased by Dr. Anderson and another purchase to Barrera. So everything that the bank had was given. So the information about that cattle that had been sold by Martin without permission from the bank was in the file that was turned over to the investigator.
Counsel,
yes.
Assume it's true that a failure to disclose can never be a sufficient basis for malicious prosecution. Assume Justice O'Neill's hypothetical where all the facts in this case are the same except that the bank's note was fully paid and the bank never told the investigator that or the DA that. What is the rationale then for your approach that an omission can never constitute or be sufficient to support malicious prosecution? What's the rationale underlying the decisions? You cited Leak, you cited Ritchie. Assuming you're right, what's the rationale for your approach, that theory?
Your Honor, you know, I would invite the court to reread Bynum Ferris versus Leak because the rationale is in Bynum Ferris versus Leak.
Assume Leak was never written. Assume Ritchie was never written. What's the rationale? The underlying compelling reason for saying an omission can never constitute a sufficient basis for malicious prosecution.
The rationale, Your Honor, is that the burden is on law enforcement to know the elements of the crime that they're investigating. The burden is not on private citizens to know what information they need to give. That is the rationale.
So then if a private citizen makes an intentionally false statement, then under your rationale, that private citizen would still not be liable because the burden is on law enforcement officials to fully investigate and know the elements.
No, Your Honor. If a complainant gives knowingly false information and that false information caused the indictment under the current state of the law, there is basis for liability for malicious prosecution.
But you're just saying it can never be knowingly false by omission. Never.
The court declared in Brown and Ferris versus Leak and in King versus Graham that it required a knowingly false statement. So that bridge has been crossed by this court in King versus Graham and Brown and Ferris versus Leak and in Walmart versus Rodriguez.
One other.
So unless the court wants to change the law,
we don't have to go as far as finding that an omission can never be sufficient for malicious prosecution in order to find in favor of your client, do we?
No, Your Honor. Here we have the investigator who investigated this case, and he said every piece of information that came from the bank was true. And
counsel,
even if the alleged statements are false, there is no evidence that any alleged false statements caused the indictment. So that's the missing link here. It's a two-prong. So Martin had the burden of proving that the action or conduct by the bank caused the indictment, and there is no evidence here. Therefore, this is why the court should render judgment in this case that the bank takes nothing and that the bank should recover the $50,000 the jury found was owed by Martin.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Larry Smith, argument please.
May it please the court. First, just as a matter of record, this record shows that the bank made knowingly false statements. They told Investigator Vasquez, one, they couldn't find any of the collateral. They had already sold off 20 head. They had authorized their bank director, Gus Barrera, to take another 15 head off
the
blood
park. Stop a second. the chairman of the board was there when the cattle were transferred, right?
Well, that's to the 95.
Let's take them away. The chairman of the board was there, and the chairman of the board did not talk to the police officer.
No, that's
so
true.
So what we're doing here is imputing everybody in the bank's knowledge to everybody else in the bank to find either negligence or intention, right?
No, Your Honor. There's direct evidence that the bank authorized the Barreras to take that 15 head.
The bank? Who?
Marcus Villanueva, the vice president.
But the ones that there was evidence that the ones that were sold when the chairman was there, what's the evidence that Villanueva knew that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What's the evidence that Villanueva knew about the ones that were sold when the chairman, or transferred when the chairman was there?
We don't have direct evidence of that. He did tell Investigator Vasquez that happened.
So let's take that one first.
Okay.
Because the fact of the matter is your guy didn't pay the loan.
Sure.
And if those 20 were not waived, then your guy did. I mean, your case that more than 75 disappeared and the bank knew about it and waived them depends on those 20 as well as the rest.
It doesn't depend on just the 20.
20 plus 58 is 78. That's how you get past the 75.
No, Your Honor. I think we're confusing different sales. The sale in 95 was a 58 head. At that time, the testimony was that Sam Martin had over 200 head of cattle. So he had, and there's independent evidence that he had over 100, maybe 150 head after that. Now, of that 140-50 head, which was more than the 75, before Investigator Vasquez came to the bank had, the evidence shows, sold 20 head at 50 cents on the dollar to the bank director and his brother. They had authorized the bank director to take other cattle. And, in fact, the evidence shows that they took, that the Barreras took another 15 head off of Bud Parker's ranch, cows that were never accounted for on the loan. Sam Martin was never given credit for those cattle. There's also evidence from the man that was hired by the bank to so-called find the cattle that there was another 7 head that they had found and claimed that that was all they could find. So there's 42 head at that time that the bank already knew about, and the evidence shows at the time they're telling the investigator that there is no collateral. They can't find any. When in fact they had already found 42
head. So when you say
head.
The bank, you mean... Is there evidence that Villanueva, the only one who talked to the police, knew each and every one of those things?
Yes, he authorized it.
Every one of those?
Yes.
The seven,
not just Villanueva.
The 7, the 15, the everything.
Yes. There's also Denny, who was the loan collector for the bank. He knew about the 7. In fact, the bank told the man they hired that 7 were the only 7 they could find.
So does your case turn on that? If one member of the bank
knows
of a waiver, and the only member of the bank that talks to the police doesn't, is it a malicious prosecution?
Well, I think we're mixing oranges and apples here. That argument...
Before you avoid the question, answer that one, and then you can avoid it, okay?
Okay. On the issue of knowing false statement, it is irrelevant what happened in 95. Okay.
I'm not talking about your case.
Okay.
This is a hypothetical case.
All right.
One member of the bank knows the loan's been paid. The person at the bank that talks to the police officer does not. Is that a malicious prosecution?
Well, yes. The bank is. That's knowledge to the bank. I mean, corporations act through their agents, and corporations get pretty big, and if you say that one agent's knowledge cannot be imputed to another one, then corporations will almost always have no liability except for a direct tort. And we're not saying that at the time Gus Barrera was an actual agent of the bank in terms of, say, liability, but his knowledge could be imputed to the bank for the reasons you all stated in Holloway. But that goes to probable cause, and
Do you think the word any? We focused a little bit on the word any. You mentioned it. Is that relative to the context? Do you think if a bank had found one cow and they had a lien on $10,000, surely that wouldn't make any difference that they said any.
Well, maybe not. I don't know. But,
well,
but
I mean, do you think it would?
But this is more than 50%.
I'm trying to get it. Is it in? Do you think any is in context?
Well, I think this context is clear.
Do you think it is? I know you think it's clear.
But well, yes.
Think the statement any has to be read in some context? That's all I'm asking.
Well, I think in the context of this case, the bank wanted to leave the impression in the context that they couldn't find any cattle, that all this collateral was gone, and that the collateral he had been sold off to Dr. Anderson 2 years before, and they couldn't find anything else. And that's in Investigator Vasquez's report. That's what they told him, and that was the basis of his report. That's what this charge is all about. There were no other cattle. That was the impression. That's not the impression. That is what they told Investigator Vasquez.
Why isn't the impression that we can't find enough to get paid? Why isn't that communication to be made?
Well, that's not what they said.
But how is that different from we can't find any?
Well, because it made it sound like the impression they left with Investigator Vasquez was that, in fact, Sam Martin didn't have any cattle. He sold it all off 2 years ago, and he's been defrauding them because, in fact, he didn't have it. When, in fact, they knew he had cattle out there. They had been picking up that cattle. And, in fact, the evidence showed that at the time of trial, they only could count for Sam Martin and his son could only account for 40 head. And before the bank started picking them up, they had 140, more than that. But there's other false statements.
Let me just ask you a legal point.
Okay.
Should the standard be any different for a false imprisonment claim?
Well, you all held in Rodriguez the same standard applied.
Okay, so we said there that failing to make full and fair disclosure is not enough.
If that discretion triggers it. You know, the holding a leak is that, in fact, you can have a lesser standard than knowing. That is the actual holding of it.
But we have said failure to make full and fair disclosure is not enough. It does not equal knowingly providing false information.
That's true.
And under that standard, isn't this clearly an erroneous jury charge?
No.
Why?
You know, in Leak, y'all held the actual holding of Leak was that the trial court did not err in refusing to give a charge on knowing. That's the actual holding of Leak.
Well, but it did say it's improper. I agree, and that's kind of weird. But it does say failure to fully and fairly disclose is not enough.
It's not the same. If the complainant's conduct was not a determining factor, it's not the discretion. And I want to speak to this point because, frankly, I think that's where there's a little confusion in Leak and why the instruction needs to be tinkered with a little bit. And I know that's sporting of me to say that, but here's the problem I see, and I wrote about it in the brief. It's not the existence of discretion, because that discretion always exists in the criminal law. I mean, it is a hallmark of our criminal justice system that prosecutors have discretion and grand juries have independence. I mean, that's even built into our Bill of Rights.
But that's on the causative end.
No, well, but that goes to procurement and what triggers the standard, because you all said that if the complainant's conduct, even if that discretion exists, if that complainant's conduct is a determining factor because of pressure of any kind, even, and the restatement example is, you know, just requesting a charge be brought up, is that kind of pressure, then that triggers a lesser standard. And that's why you held in Leak that, in fact, the full and fair disclosure in Leak was a factor. You said it might have been important in terms of bringing that prosecution. And so on that basis, you held the knowing instruction in Leak error. Or to put it the opposite way, the trial court did not err in not giving that charge. It's not the existence of discretion. It's the exercise of that discretion. Because that discretion exists in every case. It has to. It's a hallmark of our criminal justice system. No person can force a district attorney to present a case to a grand jury, and no person can force that grand jury to bring an indictment.
Why isn't that very discretion? Why isn't that very discretion you're talking about a compelling reason why the standard of fully and fairly disclose all material information, placing that burden on a private citizen is too high. What private citizen is going to know all material information involved in a criminal prosecution or criminal charge?
Well, that's true, but that's not... If they know about material information and don't disclose it, and that was a determining factor...
That's different. If they know about material information, some material information they may know about, but failure to fully and fairly disclose all material information, what does that mean? And how can we enforce that with private citizens?
Well...
If you're writing... Head off a question. Leak wasn't written, she wasn't written. Hypothetically, as of now, what's the rationale for placing that high burden on private citizens?
Because when people make that report, as the restatement says, it's causing that prosecution. Now, we're not going to hold liable just for starting that process unless... Assuming that the district attorney has total discretion on this and exercises without any pressure from any kind. But when they cause that prosecution, there is a certain level, a standard, that they have to be held liable. And if they know material information, like in a shoplifting case, take Richie, for example. Let's say that store manager had seen that customer actually pay for the cigarettes that he was accused of stealing. But he didn't tell the police. He told them everything. He walked out of that store with that package of cigarettes, but he doesn't tell the police that the guy paid for it.
Well, because the police are going to ask, did he pay for it?
Well, maybe they do, maybe they don't.
Well, the implication is that he walked out without payment, and that was one thing I want to ask you about. Counsel for the other side got questions about the note being paid. Well, when you go to the authorities and say, my collateral is impaired, my note... I've got a note outstanding. That's implicit in that is that there's a note outstanding that's unpaid, and you don't have collateral if the note's been paid. So that seemed to be sort of a red herring.
Well, but there are times when an omission does rise to the level of a false statement. I mean, y'all held that. Held that in the context of fraud.
But tell us when that is. That would be helpful.
Well, for example, here. The bank we know had taken 42 head. But they tell the investigator, and let's say that 42 head is enough to pay off this loan. And they tell the investigator that, in fact, they can't find any collateral. Sam Martin's defrauded them.
That's an affirmative statement, isn't it?
Well, that's what they said in this case.
That's not just leaving something out. That's an affirmative statement.
Well, that's what they said. This is Investigator Vasquez's testimony. Question, who was complaining about hindering a secured creditor, you or the bank? Answer, the bank. Was that on July 3rd, 1997? Yes. So they called you to complain about a criminal charge, not you calling them. Am I correct? Yes. You came there because somebody was complaining about a criminal activity. Am I correct? Yes. And Vasquez testified he didn't even know what hindering a secured creditor was. He had to ask.
Let me ask you real quickly questions on damages, on mental anguish.
Yes.
The other side says that you haven't, in your mental anguish, at most that you've proved is worry, anxiety, shame, vexation. Do you have anything in addition, or can you point to any place in the record where it rises to a level higher than what I just said?
Well, the record shows this man cried on the stand.
Man cried on the stand?
Yes. As a proud man, 58 years old, two-time candidate for sheriff, almost won once, a proud rancher, a proud father, a former law enforcement officer.
I'm not saying that that's not important. I'm just saying, is there evidence of injury, mental anguish that caused him injury over a period of time?
He testified it was traumatic. He was humiliated. Couldn't sleep. I mean, he didn't have... You know, he didn't go to a therapist or anything. This man's
what about reputation damages? Did you show at the trial what his reputation was before the incident, the tort?
Yes.
And did you show what it was after?
Yes.
And how
I mean,
did
not,
you do
not
that?
Not in that form, but before he was a respected member of the community, law enforcement officer. Father-in-law was sheriff of Cameron County for 30 years. And then afterwards, he was made jokes about him. He was ashamed. He wouldn't even file applications because he'd have to put down that, in fact, he'd been charged and indicted before.
Did you have any independent... Was the only evidence of that Martin's testimony himself?
His son testified to that also. His son testified to the trauma they suffered and their standing in the community and that sort of thing.
Are you claiming that the prosecutor was pressured in this case into...
Well, he, through the investigator, the bank requested these charges be brought.
Well, I mean, the argument's been made that really what the evidence is going to show was that the bank did no more than turn over its file. And that he seemed to have indicated there may be some sort of continuum involved if there's pressure brought to bear. And I didn't know, are you claiming... If you are claiming pressure brought to bear, specifically, what are you relying on?
Yes, there was, you know, the restatement and leak talks about either through direction, request, or I believe pressure of any kind. And an example they used, just requesting the charge, was an example of pressure of any kind in the restatement. And that's certainly what the bank did here. People don't have contact with district attorneys. I mean, and the reality is, particularly in these urban counties, I mean, they got a lot of cases. They rely on these reports. People don't usually talk directly to district attorneys about their case and their complaint. They talk to investigating officers who then file reports, and then district attorneys use those reports in the grand juries. And that's what the stipulation says here, that this report was the basis of the grand jury indictment. That's what the stipulation says. And so here, yes, there is pressure. The bank requested these charges be filed. In fact, in the attached to the bank's brief, you know, is the report of Investigator Vasquez, and it says violations hindering secured credit reported by Marcus Villanueva, July 3rd, 1997. Which, by the way, that day Marcus Villanueva testified before this jury that in fact he didn't think Sam Martin was guilty of any crime at the time he made that statement and on this day. And then on the case report. It shows the victim, Marcus Villanueva, and it shows, will victim file charges? Answer, yes. This report went to the district attorney. There's a blank there for no. But that's not what this says. This says yes. I mean, that tells the district attorney that these people are requesting charges be brought. And this, in a normal case, you know, and this was handled like any other case. That's what the stipulation was about. Almost all cases, this is what happens. And this is all district attorneys go by to decide whether to indict.
You make much of the fact that Guerrero was chairman of the board. He was along with the 20 head and all, but... Doesn't Texas law require that whatever that knowledge had been gained while he was acting within the scope of his authority, or that he had some duty within the scope of his authority to request it? Or are you saying the chairman of the board, anything they do, anything they know is imputed to their bank?
Well, if it's adverse to the corporation that they're director of, because they have a fiduciary duty to the corporation, and if they learn outside their scope of authority, and in fact, in Holloway, you said their imputed knowledge doesn't just exist at official meetings, which, by the way, most of the time, directors, their official duties consist of mostly meetings. They don't have official duties other than that. But if they learn something adverse to a corporation on their own, they have a duty, fiduciary duty, to report that to the corporation, to protect that corporation that they're a director of. That's part of their job. Otherwise, they could learn, like an Enron, you know, a director could learn about all that fraud on their own, but it would not mean anything to the... You wouldn't be able to impute that to the corporation, which that director, if they learned about all that fraud, would have a duty to do something about that.
Is there any testimony in the record about the size of the bank and the size of the community and what people knew about how many cattle were in certain ranches?
Yes, there was testimony that basically the ranchers knew, who worked that area, knew where cattle were generally. And And in fact, they do annual sort of roundups. They sort of get all the cattle together. And there's independent testimony that Martin had well over 100 head after he sold the cattle to Dr. Anderson. I mean, there's testimony from Martin, his son. There's testimony from Raul Mendez. There's testimony from Joe Serrata, who was actually hired by the bank to find the cattle. Also, Bud Parker, the rancher, he testified to that also.
But I guess I've been following up on Chief Justice Phillips' question. How do you connect that dot between the director and the bank? Is there any testimony or record showing that?
Well, the director approved this loan. There's no question. The evidence is clear that he knew about this loan at the time that he helped Martin sell the cattle. If he thought that act was adverse to the corporation, he had a duty to report that. And under Holloway, his knowledge is imputed to the corporation. If the corporation is now claiming that's an adverse act, which they obviously were, then they certainly had a duty. And you have to look at it from Sam Martin's perspective. I mean, here he is, the director of the bank, is helping him with this sale of cattle. He testified that he thought that, given that and normal procedure, which is, ranchers pay off their loans by selling cattle. That's how they do it. He thought there wasn't any problem with this, particularly when the bank director, who knew of the loan and approved that loan.
Was there any testimony about the directors that were involved in the day-to-day business of the bank?
Well, there's evidence that the director was very involved in the collection of the collateral in this case.
Of course, if he thought the bank had been paid off when they foreclosed on set off part of his checking account, he could have mentioned that instead of saying, "You will never see from or hear me again," right?
Oh, there's no question that Sam Martin lost his cool that day. But that didn't give the bank the right to take his cattle without reimbursing him and then seek criminal charges against him when, in fact, those investigators came to the bank and asked the bank, "Did y'all take that cattle?" Because they were investigating a cattle rustling charge. And they want to know if the bank had taken it, and the bank says no. Sam Martin never had it. They deflected the criminal investigation from themselves to Sam Martin. That's what happened in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Rhodes will present the motion.
May it please the court. A review of the record in this case makes one thing unmistakably clear, and that is that this case was tried on a failure to disclose theory. You have to look no farther than counsel's own closing argument to the jury, where, in speaking about the procurement instruction, he told the jury that the procurement instruction allows you to find procurement for a failure to disclose. He speaks about the fact that there was evidence, and there was evidence, we have to admit that, there was evidence the bank did not tell Vasquez.
What about the statement, we can't find any cattle? That's not just leaving something out, that's an affirmative statement, isn't it?
Your Honor, the statement needs to be taken in the context of what they were talking about. And the context is they were talking about the bank needed 75 head of cattle still to satisfy the amount that Martin owed on this loan at that particular time. That's undisputed evidence. The fact that the bank had found 20 cattle before is really irrelevant to the fact that they still needed 75 head of cattle, which is what Villanueva's report is complaining about, that we need 75 head of cattle. The security agreement gave the bank a security interest in all cattle owned by Martin, including but not limited to 75 head. The idea was that 75 head would cover the amount of the loan, but subsequently, Martin added a car note to that, and so obviously we may come need more cattle if that's the secured interest that we have. But we have a security interest in all of this cattle, not just 75 head. And so the fact that we said we couldn't find it, we said any of the livestock put up as collateral, that's what the actual statement was from the record, any of the livestock put up as collateral, and we were looking for, at that point in time, 75 head of cattle. So I do not believe that that's a false statement.
So they didn't make the statement that we can't find any of the cattle?
We cannot. The statement was any of the livestock that had been put up as collateral. That was the statement that was made.
Okay.
But in closing argument to the jury, this is Martin's closing argument. He refers to the fact that these 20 cattle that were sold in May to the bank director's brother. He says that wasn't provided, that wasn't told to the investigator. And he says, it's not there. It's not in the report. So that means Villanueva didn't tell Vasquez lies, but he kept all the information. He failed to disclose the information. Vasquez made it. Told me that. I may not have had an indictment. Now, this is their own closing argument. So the argument we brought up earlier, Judge Schneider, about harmless error, the argument that this failure to disclose theory can be harmless error is really a red herring here when their own closing argument did not identify for the jury one allegedly false statement. The false statements that have been presented to the court were developed on appeal. They were developed later on appeal. They were not ever argued to the jury that these are false statements. And this is somewhat important in that Investigator Vasquez would not testify that he had been given any false statements. Martin tried and tried and tried to get Vasquez to testify that you've been given a false statement. And Vasquez kept saying, no, I wasn't given a false statement, I just wasn't told everything. Now, the reason that's important is, since Vasquez wouldn't testify that he had been given a false statement, there is no evidence that correlates or that ties up any alleged false statement to the decision to prosecute. And if you go back to this court's per curiam opinion that was just recently issued in King versus Graham, this court said that the plaintiff has to present evidence that the plaintiff has to present evidence showing that the alleged false statement caused the prosecution. That just can't be inferred unless all of the information the bank gave was false. And here there's plenty of undisputed information that the bank gave to Vasquez that was true. There's no dispute about it. Martin was a debtor under a security agreement. He did not have the right to sell cattle, and he did sell cattle subject to the security agreement without the written consent of the bank. And that undisputed evidence was enough to cause a prosecution.
But I thought all that was disputed. I thought it was disputed the number of cattle, that he thought he could sell cattle that wasn't the subject of the agreement. He thought he could sell anything over 75, and there was disputed evidence as to how many head there were, whether that agreement was part of the original loan agreement. There was a lot of disputed evidence.
The loan agreements, or the security agreements, were clear, Your Honor. It's all cattle, including but not limited to 75 head. There was one document signed in 1992, it was a notice form that went to the local auction house that said 75 cattle. But even if that created an ambiguity, there were 12 other subsequent security agreements signed, including adding the car. So that those 1992 loan documents were not part of the loan that was defaulted on. The loan that was defaulted on had the security agreement of all head and cattle, all cattle, including but not limited to the 75 head, plus a car. So that was a different security agreement. So that's to be real honest, as a matter of law, it's clear that we had a security interest in all of the cattle. With respect to his argument that he thought he could sell, I mean, that was brought up, that this was a calf-cow operation and that's how you pay. You could sell calves, but you weren't supposed to sell bulls and mother cows, because that's how you make more cattle.
Where does it say that?
It's in the security agreement, Your Honor.
About the bulls and the mother cows?
It talks about, it's in our briefs too. We explain the distinction between bulls, and even Martin admitted that you don't sell bulls and mother cows. He admitted that in his testimony, that you don't sell bulls and mother cows because that's how you have a calf-cow operation. You use the bulls and mother cows to make more calves, and then you sell off the calves, but not the bulls and the mother cows.
But that's not distinguished in the security agreement. The security agreement just says cattle.
The actual language of what is a secure, we have a security interest is including but not limited to all, this is how it works, Sean, I'm sorry, including but not limited to all cattle, including but not limited to 75 head of cattle, all cattle, including but not limited to 75 head of cattle. If you go and you look at, you may sell certain things in the ordinary course of business, and there are certain things that you have to have written consent for. And Martin admitted on the stand that the ordinary course of business in a calf cow operation was that you sell calves, that you don't sell bulls and other cattle. But those are the types of things that have to have the express consent of the bank in advance. That's not something that somebody has beforehand.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.